you have to maintain really this mindset of being keen on a case, but not being too keen, and keeping an open mind as to where the pitfalls might be. There has to be damages well north of £10 million, preferably mid to high value, hundreds of millions is ideal.
Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. Uncorrelated investments are a term all too frequently employed in the world of investing, and yet history shows that at times of sharp market setbacks and exogenous shocks, assets, although appearing to offer low correlation, often behave very similarly. Now, that's typically a consequence of the rush to raise liquidity and reduce risk by market participants. Now, litigation funding would appear to have some different characteristics, and here to discuss and explain the evolution of this niche asset class, the alternative, and the investment opportunity, I'm delighted to have Robert Rothkopp, founder of Balanced Legal Capital. Welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you, Simon. Great to be here.
Well, I hope today we'll be able to drill down into this investment opportunity and understand, first of all, why, following your very successful career as a litigator with Herbert Smith, you and some colleagues with equally stellar legal backgrounds have been so excited by the potential investment returns in this space that you built this business. So first of all, how you constructed it, description of the funds themselves, the investment approach, the potential returns and timelines, risks, competition, allocating capital and exits. So lots to talk about.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much for having me on. And you touched there on the uncorrelated nature of litigation funding. And it certainly is a very important aspect of this asset class, and why investors are very keen on it. As you know, litigation funding is essentially the non-recourse finance of a piece of litigation. And if the case settles or wins, then the financier will take a return from the damages that are won. And the process that drives the return is a court or tribunal process that has nothing to do with the wider market, which insulates it to a high degree from what else is going on.
We're going to get into the weeds here, but something struck me. We are living right now in an economically uncertain time. Some would say that's often the case, but particularly because we've gone through sharp rate rises and the consequences are playing out. At a high level, would you say that maybe this investment category is almost counter-cyclical?
Well, yes, in some ways, we have noticed that in economic downturns, that often prompts sharper practices, contracts that are not honored, breaches of duty, and so on, tend to increase as conditions are tougher out there. That's for sure. The opportunity for litigation funding is huge and relatively underdeveloped. It's certainly become part of the landscape in the UK, in Australia, in the US, and other jurisdictions.
And in terms of sizing this marketplace, I've read that the value of court cases has increased 400%. And I'm not sure how you define or measure that marketplace. Just give us a sense of how you think about the opportunity.
So there's definitely been an increase in capital that's being allocated to the world of litigation finance because it's uncorrelated nature. There's a lot of benefits to law firms and businesses in using litigation finance, which we can get onto. In terms of sizing the quantum of damages that are in dispute at any one time in the courts, that's a bit of a moving feast. But the estimates that have been done show that 3% or so of courtroom litigation at the moment, only 3% is actually funded by third parties like us, meaning that there's a huge market potential there.
So I'd want to just jog backwards because to frame your own journey, I think I'm right in saying you studied biochemistry at Oxford before you switched tack and became a lawyer. Just tell us a little bit before we get to Balanced Legal Capital, what your journey was, because that's very relevant.
So I studied biochemistry at Oxford before then switching to the accelerated law degree in London. And I was very interested in science, still am, but I found the life in the lab to be too solitary, too prone to lab technician breakdowns, and decided that the internships that I was doing along the way with law firms, investment banks, was pacey, energetic, intellectually stimulating as well. So it was a clear decision for me to move away from science and into law. And I luckily got a training contract with Herbert Smith. I hadn't realized that then they were and still are the leading disputes firm. And during my training with them, angled the departments that I sat in towards dispute resolution and found that I really enjoyed examining the evidence, arguing a point of view, the adversarial nature of life as a litigator. And I got to do some secondments to BP, which is still one of Herbert's biggest clients. And that was a really good experience because from a relatively junior stage, I was tasked with managing a portfolio of cases that BP was facing. And sometimes I'd be the only litigator running the case, or I'd get to instruct an external law firm to run the case and advise us. And that gave me a really interesting position sitting in the client's chair of what it is that makes a good legal advisor and allows a business to make a decision in a high-stakes situation.
So there you are, great firm, niche that clearly is flourishing, and you decide to leave the firm. Where was the epiphany and why?
Well, so I had a great time at Herbert Smith, and one of the final chapters was that I was sent to New York to help set up their disputes practice there. And this was in end of 2012. And again, that was an interesting entrepreneurial legal role. But whilst I was there, we were instructed by an existing litigation funder to help them due diligence one of their investments. And the metrics of the case and the investment that they were looking at was roughly, they were looking to invest $5 million. And if the case settled or succeeded at trial, they would take out $25 million. And I just thought, wow, this is an asymmetric opportunity. And really, if you're the investor in a case, you're sitting in a much more aligned position than being the lawyer advising on the case, where that's intellectually stimulating as far as it goes. But I then realized that this was going to become, this litigation funding phenomenon was going to increase and become part of the landscape.
And before we get to the firm and the fund, just a general question is, what do you think characterizes a good litigator?
Well, we spend a lot of time thinking about this because, as we'll get on to, a key part of our investment criteria is backing the right lawyers for the right case. But more generally, I think litigators need to have a real eye for detail. That's where the devil is. They have to be able to also then step back from the minutiae and think strategically. They have to know what their client's objectives are, really understand what a win looks like, and have a read on the opponent and have a read on the decision maker, being the judge or the arbitral tribunal, and tailor the advocacy, tailor the, whether that's written or oral in the courtroom, you really tailor that for the maximum effect. So it's a multi-pronged skill set.
So armed with some of those skills, you have decided that this is the way to go. Just talk a little bit about how you drew the personalities that were going to help you succeed on this mission together and who they are.
When I quit Herbert Smith in 2015, I had a few real strokes of luck. One of them was Herbert Smith allowed me to use their corporate department, some very big brains to set up the business, and a very generous deferred fee arrangement. And I also was at the firm, had gotten to know Lord David Gold, who was the senior partner of Herbert Smith, a venerable litigator, shrewd litigation strategist. He had left Herbert Smith around 2012. So I was in touch with him, and he had been considering this line of business as well and was keen to join. And I'd also been talking to a UK family office who had made ad hoc investments in the space but wanted to back a new team. So I managed to juggle those things. And I was also introduced to Simon Burnett, who had just finished an MBA with London Business School and was a litigator with Freshfields. So we came together and managed to entice Lord Gold, who's one of the big cases that Lord Gold did was to be brought on by Roman Abramovich, who in his very large case against Boris Berezovsky, which took over much of the London legal community back in the day, he's often brought on as strategic advisor in Bet the Farm type situations. And we also managed to bring in Ian Terry, who was Simon's boss at Freshfields. Ian Terry was the global managing partner of Freshfields and head of their dispute resolution division. And again, another big name in litigation now sits as a mediator at One Essex Court. And it seems trite to say it now, but we were very much of the view that in order to make this business a success, we needed the experience, the expertise in case selection, making those predictions on whether a case is going to settle or win and for how much. But we also needed very good origination capabilities. And we were able to draw our networks from our practice to make that happen.
Yes, I remember Ian Terry was Steve Jobs' go-to lawyer, particularly when Apple was sued by the Beatles. So investors will be very familiar with that gathering of expertise around the table to be able to start the investment diagnosis. So let's talk about that. And at the highest level, I am intrigued as to how you go about identifying possible situations that you want to fund.
So it's a process that we have honed over the years as we really narrow in on what it is we're looking for. But we're in the business of only backing cases with merit because they have to either settle or win and make a windfall that is able to finance the capital that we have advanced and leave enough for the claimant so that there's no buyer's remorse at the end of the day. And there has to be proportionality between the amount of damages at stake and the amount of budget that it's going to take to get there. And lawyers, as everybody will know, are not cheap. And to launch a piece of litigation, the budget required for the litigation solicitors, the barristers, the expert witnesses, other transcription services, all these things are not trivial. And businesses therefore like partnering with us, and law firms like partnering with us, because we are able to advance the funds needed for those expenses on a non-recourse basis. Non-recourse meaning that if the case loses, we don't get to take back any cash. It's all out of proceeds only.
So I understand that you focus on areas that you have expertise in. That means commercial disputes and group actions in the UK, Australia, and other common law jurisdictions. But let's stay with that due diligence because this is, as I said, a parallel with the investment world, and a potential case lands on your desk and is introduced to you. Just talk a little bit about how wide and how deep you will go in your due diligence.
So the due diligence process has got to be done rigorously and objectively, and you have to maintain really this mindset of being keen on a case, but not being too keen, and keeping an open mind as to where the pitfalls might be. There has to be damages well north of £10 million, preferably mid to high value, hundreds of millions is ideal. We have to make sure that the defendant has got the capacity to pay. There's no point in backing a case that's meritorious if at the end of the investment, it's a Pyrrhic victory, either because the defendant can't pay or because their assets are in a jurisdiction that you can't get your hands on. So there will be lots of cases that we are quick to reject on those grounds. Because we're litigators ourselves, and we've run lots of cases similar to the ones we're looking at ourselves, we're able to move through that due diligence process quickly. We have weekly investment committee meetings with our investment committee, looking at 1 week the UK cases, the other week Australian cases. Those are our two core jurisdictions. And we can iterate the DD process through that. And one thing that we really make sure is whether the legal team that has got carriage of the case has the competence to win, as compared to the other side, who might be tooling up with top end of town. And we have to make sure, do the barristers who are instructed on this case have the expertise necessary? And with the evolution of some of our cases early on, I think we didn't realize the importance of having excellent solicitors in the driving seat on your side.
So when we talk about the number of cases that come for review and how many are not pursue? Just give us a sense of how many. It's just like this, the 50-50 stock ideas getting taken down to 10. Give us a sense of the ratio.
So we're very picky eaters. We have to be. We've invested in 5% of the cases that we have looked at. And that will include the cases that are very easy rejections and also the cases that take a bit more time. But once they get to our investment committee, we're more at a 30% approval rate. And one criterion that I think is very important for us at Balance is that we're seen to be on the right side of the case. We apply, you know, a reputational test or a front page of the newspaper test to make sure that if it became known publicly that we were funding the case or if our investors knew, would there be any misgivings there? So on that front, we have turned down cases against universities, hospitals, impoverished island states, anything where a win would actually be provocative and would give us a bad feeling.
So that definitely falls under the G for governance in ESG. But just give us a sense of how many cases are live being funded by you at any point in time.
So right now, live cases around 40. And we've got a spread of diversified case types. That's between the UK and Australia. And we also invest in other common law jurisdictions. So Hong Kong and Singapore jurisdictions we'll look at too. And we're backing commercial disputes and group actions and class actions. That's our focus. We don't do family law disputes or generally personal injury type cases. It's not our expertise. And it's also, as an investment, brings in dynamics that are more emotional rather than rational resolution available. So that's something we steer away from.
Okay, so you define the landscape, you define this investment process, the narrowing of the potential opportunity set. Now, somebody's got to pull the trigger. Tell us a little bit about how that part of the execution takes place.
So the investment committee process is something that we've really worked hard to hone. One thing that I'm very interested in is the cognitive biases that can take hold in any decision-making process. And whilst we've got very expert litigators on our investment committee and in the team, I'm aware that you can fall in love with a case, you can be the loud advocate around the table, and those dynamics can sometimes suppress misgivings or risks that would be raised by one member of the committee but aren't. So what we have done is we've developed a proprietary decision-making tool. We call it Hawkeye, where every member of the investment committee reviews the memos, the opinions from the barristers, expert reports, and so on individually, and will score the case on various aspects that matter prior to our first meeting. And then in the meeting, this is all straight from Daniel Kahneman and Philip Tetlock books. In the meeting, we make sure that we have a period of neutral questions where people ask questions without uttering what their conclusions might be. And then we'll move into this phase where we'll show a big reveal of what people thought and how they might want to change their views following the discussion. And I think that has really helped us to reduce those biases that can make for bad decisions.
And the last part of that, which is very difficult, is the sizing of the investment, because some of the potential returns are going to look very large, maybe or maybe not with attendant risks. Just explain to me how you therefore take that next step, how big the commitment you want to make relative to the size of the return.
So that's a great question. We've found, and lots of other litigators or funders listening to this will appreciate and agree, that the size of the case doesn't necessarily have a bearing on the amount of work needed to due diligence it, execute on the deal. And sometimes the actual burden on the litigation team and the budgets can also be disproportionate to the amount at stake. And we've got to avoid that. I've got to be mindful of the bandwidth of my team. We're now 18 people. We have a London office, Sydney office, but we're also managing $300 million. We have to be careful not to spend too much time on the smaller deals. And by the same token, we don't want to become too concentrated on one particular case type that could be affected by a change in law that could knock out a number of cases. So we make sure that there's diversification and we stick to a single case investment limit, which has been growing as our AUM has grown. Luckily, I'd just say we have a great group of LP investors who are keen on co-investments as well. So there's almost no limit to the size of budget that we can fund in the right instance.
Now, your firm has been described in Chambers and Partners UK Guide, which I have to confess is not a typical part of my weekly reading, as up and coming and hungry and a market disruptor, which brings me to the question of competition. Tell me a little bit about how you view how competitive this is becoming.
So competition has always been there. I think actually whoever made those kind statements might have been referring to the fact that we brought with us into this business an ethos of really trying to be good partners and build a speedy, rigorous decision-making process. So I think when we first started, there was this sense that the incumbent funders had been used to having the market all to themselves, and we came in and were more responsive. We carved out a space by moving more quickly. And that ethos is something we are absolutely preserving, even though we're bigger and more established than back in 2015, 8 years ago. So the competition, also one key differentiator for us, is that we have full delegated control over our capital. So when we make a decision to invest, we don't have to get sign off from a distant investment committee at a hedge fund, which is the case for many of our investors. And that can lead to real problems, because getting a deal across the line, working with a law firm, doing the whole DD process, is not a trivial time investment. So we know that some law firms have become disgruntled by the fact that they may have gotten through the hoops at the funder they're working with, only to find that the hedge fund behind that funder says no. And we don't have that structure, which has been a real advantage. And then our other differentiator is that we don't just set our investment and leave it. We are, on a take it or leave it basis, also able to offer our strategic views on a case as we go along, which is, I think, a source of real value and comfort for the insolvency practitioners we work with, and corporates and class representatives. So there is competition, but I think there is also an understanding of what the cost of capital in this space needs to be in order for the winners to pay for the losers within a portfolio. And there's a lot of litigation out there. So I think the pipeline is not waning by any means.
So I think investors, potential investors listening to this, will be getting a fairly clear understanding of your process and the objectives. Maybe we could take an example or two to flesh out, so we can talk about situations that have come up that you've had to deal with and how they've worked.
So why don't I give a UK example and an Australian example? So one in the UK, we were approached by the liquidators of Patisserie Valerie, which, for the UK-based listeners, they will remember the ubiquitous cafe chain in the high streets in the UK. That was an AIM-listed business that collapsed when it became known that their financial statements were wrong. And we were asked to see whether we would fund a professional negligence claim against the auditors, which we then did, and it settled on confidential terms about 18 months later. And this was a high-risk case, could have been fought for many, many years. But we allowed the estate to make a return to creditors, which otherwise would not have been possible without our assistance. So that's an example of the insolvency commercial areas where we can assist. In Australia, we did a case which was a class action on behalf of lots of people who had bought add-on insurance products at the time of buying cars on finance. And what the problem with these insurance products, tire and rim and extended warranties and so on, was that they had so many exclusions that they were actually worthless. As a product, they were defective. And the sales tactics of the insurance agents in the car yards was misleading in terms of conveying to the customers that they needed to agree to take on these insurance products in order to qualify for the finance to get their car. And you can imagine the pressure they were under with a beautiful car sitting there in the showroom. And all you need to do to take this away is take these boxes. So we funded a class action that settled for $140 million, which was that year the largest case settlement in Australia. And that money then went back to compensate the individuals who had been misled. So it was a really good example, again, of how this investment class promotes access to justice for individuals who otherwise wouldn't get redress.
When you think about competitive advantage and you versus the competition, is there something that gives you more comfort that your moat is wider than others?
Well, so what we found over the years since we started is that we are getting repeat business from law firms and insolvency practitioners who have had good experiences partnering with us. And that will continue because they understand that this isn't just about price. There's no race to the bottom here. We are able to add more than just blind capital. And that is a source of comfort when considering competitive forces, for sure.
Am I right in saying from earlier conversations that there seems to be a recurring theme that the auto industry has, for whatever reason, made itself more vulnerable than others to litigation?
Yes, it does seem to find itself in difficulties in a number of fronts. We're funding group action in the UK against BMW for producing diesel cars with allegedly defeat devices that cheat the emissions test, similar to the Volkswagen Dieselgate scandal. And we've got the same case against Peugeot, Citroën, Vauxhall, also in the UK. And then in Australia, we funded a class action for 260,000 Toyota car owners who had a defective component in their diesel car called a DPF, the diesel particulate filter. And that case we won at first instance. It's worth about $2 billion if everybody gets their compensation, because the judge found that the value of the car on the day they bought it, because it had this defect, was worth almost 20% less than what they paid, and they're entitled to that compensation. Toyota is appealing, of course, and we're pressing on with that. But it seems that car manufacturers in that area have got the same issue in Jaguar Land Rover, where we're funding cases against them too. So where I'm often asked, how diversified is your portfolio? And we can point to the fact that we do have lots of different cases. Happily, though, we do sometimes see that good cases can be replicated. And we're building a bit of an expertise in quite some technical aspects of auto car cases. And the add-on insurance case that I mentioned is something that we're also funding against other insurance companies that were doing exactly the same thing at the time.
So let's talk a little bit about funds, structure, and the profit participation. So the basic economics for the fund investors are a revenue share, if successful. Is it about 20-25% of the proceeds?
So when we price a piece of litigation with a claimant and the law firm and other stakeholders, it works out to be in the region of 20-40% of the proceeds, but we express our funding return as a multiple of the capital that we're putting at risk. And that generally works out to be in the order of that magnitude.
And in terms of how you've structured these funds, because you have cases, they run off, new cases come along, just to explain how many iterations have happened.
So we are now in our third fund vehicle. We're looking to raise a fourth next year. And these are closed-ended funds. We have to be mindful of duration of each investment, make sure that it fits snugly within the life of the fund. There are instances where cases can go onto a secondary market. That is an area that's developing. So a case that might be in the tail of one fund could be shifted to another, because investors have to be ready for the fact that some cases can go longer than previously expected. We model on the basis that cases will take, on average, three and a half years. And some cases will take longer than that.
Well, you're getting into my question, because I scratched my head and I went back to that great Charles Dickens book, Bleak House, and the Jarndyce versus Jarndyce case, where Dickens writes the one great principle of English law is to make business for itself. And of course, cases can drag on. So investors thinking about timelines and how long these funds run for?
So I think when Dickens was writing, there were lots of problems in the court system, particularly in the UK. But now, through various reforms, there are cost sanctions for failure to turn up. And the judges are much better now at managing the parties and keeping the timetables tight. In some instances, you will have diary clashes where the availability of counsel means that a hearing can't happen at a certain date and things can delay. But I think it's incumbent on the parties, the legal team that we're funding, to make sure that they can see a route to keeping the timeline efficient. And we've got in Australia as well, the federal court, for example, they're very efficient. So whilst some cases can then be appealed, you can get some duration drag. For the most part, across the portfolio, we'll get cases that also settle much more quickly than the average. So it works out.
And does each fund have a closure date?
Yes. So they're all fixed term with some extension options at our discretion as well.
So if you were to say, what are the three characteristics that make for an ideal investor, what would they be?
Well, this is quite an esoteric asset class, but it's uncorrelated. So we want investors who understand that, understand that there will be ups and downs in litigation. And I think that patient capital is certainly an important feature. We find that most of our investors are university endowment funds, family offices, some financial institutions with pension funds behind them, and they have been very supportive. I think we have the ideal investment base, actually, and they are keen to follow us into the future.
Now, as we know, all investments have pitfalls. What keeps you awake at night?
Well, as people will know, litigation is a risky process. And part of the reason why the returns that we can hope to make are relatively high compared to other asset classes is because of this high risk nature. And we work tirelessly to minimize that risk in our due diligence phase, and then with active monitoring of the case as it goes. But there are instances where a document will come to light in a case that changes the complexion and the risk of a given case. You never know how well an advocate or a witness or a judge is going to perform on a given day because of the fragilities of human beings. So we manage that risk by having a very diversified portfolio and lots of cases so that the chances of unexpected and negative consequences over the portfolio is manageable.
We talked earlier on about governance and your selection process of partnering with the right types of situations. More broadly, given that ESG thinking applies across all investments, how do you respond to the question of how compliant and sensitive are you?
So the whole ESG and impact area is important to investors, but not all investors, we found. And when we're thinking about our investment style, happily, a lot of the factors that make for a good litigation funding investment are also compatible with an impact or ESG slant anyway. And they always have been before the concept of impact or ESG really became such a hot topic. But our thoughts on this are evolving. We've always been an ethical funder. We want to be on the right side and we would do no harm. But we have to make an investment return for our investors. But if you look at the definition of impact investing, which talks about having environmental, social, governance impacts alongside a financial return, I think that's exactly what we're doing in many of our cases. There will be some cases where the parties, company A versus company B, fight it out and we fund one side and the impact of that case brings about justice for those parties, but doesn't have any wider implications. But then there'll be the cases where, like our emissions cases, like the case we did for casual workers who were under sham contracting arrangements and therefore denied entitlements by their contractors, cases on behalf of solar panel businesses whose businesses were affected by change in law. Those cases clearly have climate change or environmental benefits as well. And a lot of our cases are for groups of individuals who, many of whom might be low income individuals, for whom this slice of the compensation pot is meaningful. So I think many of our cases cover a lot of these broader goals and some don't. But luckily for us, we don't need to change really our criteria right now. We stick to the same criteria that we always have. And it just so happens that it translates nicely into, I think, what investors are looking for. What investors are looking for is also an evolving piece. So hard to keep everyone happy.
Well, as it happens, coincidentally, I sit on one investment committee whose investment with you predates me. And the principal did say the other day has been one of his most successful investments. So although we know past performance is no guarantee to the future, what would allow you to give yourself a pat on the back in 5 years' time?
Well, I would be thrilled if in 5 years' time, I can look back and see that the returns that we pitched to investors have been met or exceeded. That would be wonderful. We're on track to do that. And I think one of the driving, motivating factors of our business is that we are bringing about access to justice for people and holding corporations to account for producing polluting, defective products, or that there's this collateral effect of what we're doing, which is very positive for the world. And that's extremely satisfying.
Well, Robert, this has been terrific, and we'll have all the show notes and links available, and for should potential investors want to follow up. I heard you talk in another situation, and you described one of the qualities needed as the ability to inhale a lot of detail, which stayed with me because it's quite a skill to be able to do that. And I think that you've explained the case today that this is what one might describe as an alternative that is countercyclical, that is not for everybody, but it has some extremely interesting characteristics. And I think your process has been very well explained today. So I thank you very much for being here today on the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you so much, Simon. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.